I have to be honest with you, when you sent over the reading material for today's deep dive, I opened the first file, looked at the title, and I
Oh.
almost just closed my laptop.
Ain't that bad, huh?
It was so intimidating. The title alone, comments on the paper, the structure of the broad faces of ferrite plates. It felt like I was, walking into the middle of a conversation I wasn't invited to.
I get it.
And then you start skimming, and it's just wall-to-wall jargon, Burgers vectors, lattice planes, sessile interfaces. I felt like I needed a PhD just to read the abstract.
I completely get that. It is dense stuff. But here's the secret. Beneath all that terrifying vocabulary, this is actually a drama.
A drama inside a piece of steel.
A high-stakes detective story. We're zooming in way, way down to the atomic level. And the mystery isn't who doing it. The mystery is how did they move?
Okay, you have my attention. Set the scene for me.
So we're looking at the birth of a very specific structure inside steel called Widmanstetten ferrite.
Widmanstetten. That is fun to say.
It is, isn't it? And it's crucial because this structure, this pattern, gives steel certain properties. But back in the early 80s, there was this massive heated debate in the metallurgy world about how this thing actually forms.
And that's what this stack of papers is about.
Exactly. We're looking at a paper and a very spicy addendum published in Scripta Metallurgica in 1983 by a researcher named HKDH Padacia. He's essentially stepping into the ring to take on a rival group of scientists.
So it's a battle of the brains.
It really is. And the core of the fight is, well, it's surprisingly simple. It's about movement. On one side, you have the diffusion camp,
Right.
and on the other, you have the displacive camp.
Okay, let's pause there because I saw these terms all over the document, diffusional versus displacive. Can you break that down for me without, the textbook definitions?
Sure. Think of a crowded room.
Oh.
And let's say everyone needs to get from the main hall into the dining room next door. If it's diffusion, think of it like, well, a cocktail party mingling. People move individually, they wander, they squeeze past each other randomly, there's no pattern. Eventually, they all end up in the dining room, but how they got there was a chaotic individual scramble.
So like a mosh pit or just a disorganized crowd.
A disorganized crowd is perfect.
Yeah.
That's diffusion, random atomic jumping. This was the view held by the opposition researchers like Rigsby and Aronson. They believed these steel structures formed by atoms just wandering into place.
Okay. So what's the other side? Displacive.
The displacive camp, which Padacia is defending, is totally different. Imagine that same crowd, but suddenly a whistle blows. They link arms, form a line, and march into the dining room in perfect formation.
Like a military drill.
Exactly. It's a coordinated military march.
Yeah.
Every person keeps their position relative to their neighbor.
Yeah.
If you were standing next to Bob in the hall, you were standing next to Bob in the dining room.
So chaos versus discipline, scrambling versus marching.
Precisely. And while that might sound like a purely theoretical difference, it changes everything about what the steel actually looks like and how it behaves.
And Padacia is writing this paper to prove the atoms are marching.
Yes, he is systematically dismantling the chaos argument, piece by piece.
Okay, let's get into the evidence. Because looking at this paper, the first battleground seems to be something called the interface.
Right, the boundary, where the old structure ends and the new one begins.
And this is where I got stuck on the vocabulary. There are two words that keep popping up: glissile and sessile.
Ah, yes, these are great words.
Sessile sounds like a sea creature, like a barnacle.
That's actually a perfect association. Sessile in biology means fixed in one place, immobile. In metallurgy, it means the exact same thing. A sessile interface is stuck. It can't move sideways. It can only grow by atoms jumping across it one by one.
Okay, so sessile equals stuck and glissile.
Think glissade in ballet or glide. It means slippery. A glissile interface can slide effortlessly through the metal.
Okay, got it. Slippery versus stuck.
Now, the opposition Rigsby and his team, they looked at this interface in Widmanstetten ferrite and said, it's sessile. It is absolutely stuck.
And why were they so sure? What did they see?
Well, they saw a mathematical problem. They looked at the atomic misalignment, specifically something called the Burgers vector.
Whoa, slow down. Burgers vector. Is that
Yeah.
related to food?
Sadly, no. It's named after a physicist, Jan Burgers. Imagine a crystal lattice is like a perfectly grid-lined sheet of graph paper.
Okay, I'm picturing the grid.
Now imagine you cut a slit in the paper and you shove an extra half row of squares in there. The grid gets distorted, right?
Yeah, it creates a bulge, a wrinkle.
That wrinkle is a dislocation. The burger's vector is just an arrow that tells you the direction and size of that wrinkle. It describes the distortion.
Got it. So it's the direction of the glitch in the matrix.
Exactly. Now, Rigsby calculated this vector, and he found that it was lying flat, right inside the plane of the interface.
Okay. Why does that matter?
Imagine you have a heavy rug on the floor, and there is a big wrinkle in that rug. If you're standing on the rug and the wrinkle is trapped under your feet, can you slide the rug?
No. I'd be stepping on the distortion. It would be locked.
Exactly. That was their argument. They said, look, the distortion is trapped in the plane. Physically, this interface cannot glide. It is sessile.
That actually sounds really convincing. If the mechanics say it's locked, it's locked.
It was very convincing. It was the prevailing view. But this is where Padacia looks at their data, the exact same data, and says, you're missing the forest for the trees.
How so?
He argues they were looking too closely. They were focusing on these tiny microscopic little steps that aligned with a specific crystal plane. But Padacia said, zoom out. If you look at the macroscopic interface, the actual average line of the boundary, it's not where they thought it was.
It's in a different place.
It's rotated by about 15 to 20 degrees.
Wait, so the rug isn't where they thought it was?
The whole rug is tilted. And because the whole interface is tilted, that burger's vector, that distortion arrow, it doesn't lie flat in the plane anymore. It sticks out.
And if it sticks out?
It's not trapped. The interface isn't locked. It can move conservatively. It can glide.
So he turned their own math against them.
In a way, yes. He showed that if you look at the big picture, the macroscopic habit plane, the geometry actually allows for a slippery glissolal interface. The atoms can march.
Okay, so that's strike one against the stuck theory.
Yeah.
But then we get to what felt like the biggest piece of evidence in the whole paper, the shape change.
Yes. This is the smoking gun.
The paper calls it invariant plane strain, or IPS, which again sounds terrifying. But you annotated the section with deck of cards.
Right. Let's go back to our visualization.
Yeah.
Imagine you have a perfectly polished flat block of steel, a mirror finish.
Okay, shiny.
Now, you heat it up, you let this Widman set and ferret form, and then you cool it down and look at the surface again. It is no longer flat.
It's bumpy.
It's specifically tilted. It looks like someone took a deck of cards and just pushed the top half sideways. It's a shear.
Okay, yeah, I can picture that. A sharp slant.
Padacia argues this shape change is the ultimate proof of the military march.
Why? Why can't the wandering crowd make that shape?
Well, think about it. If you have diffusion, that chaotic cocktail party atoms are jumping randomly. One jumps left, one jumps right, one jumps up. There is zero coordination.
So they would just create a blob.
Exactly. They would swell out in all directions.
Yeah.
There is no reason for millions of atoms to randomly decide to all shift exactly 10 degrees to the left. That requires discipline. It requires a plan.
So the fact that the surface is tilted means the atoms must have moved in a coordinated way.
Correct. An invariant plane strain, that's shear, implies that atom A in the parent structure corresponds to atom A in the new structure. They move together. That is the very definition of a displacive transformation.
But didn't the other guys, Rigsby and Aronson, know about this? I mean, they're looking at the same steel. How did they explain the tilt?
This is where it gets really interesting. They try to argue that maybe, just maybe, diffusion could create this shape under very specific circumstances.
Why can it?
Theoretically. Maybe. Padacia even cites a guy named J.W. Christian who did the math. He said, it is geometrically possible to get a shape change with diffusion, but there's a massive catch.
There's always a catch in physics.
The catch is heat. To get atoms to diffuse that much, to move around that freely, you need high temperatures.
Okay.
But at high temperatures, metal gets soft. It relaxes. If you tried to build a sharp, tilted shape out of soft, hot metal, what do you think happens?
It would slump. It would lose the sharp edge.
Exactly. It would recrystallize. The strain would just wipe itself out. So Padacia argues, if this was diffusion, the shape change should have disappeared. The surface should be messy. But it's not. It's sharp. It's defined. Therefore,
it couldn't have been diffusion.
Right. It happened too fast and too precisely for it to be a random hot scramble.
He also brings up a comparison here to something called allotriomorphic ferrite. Now, I practiced saying that in the mirror this morning.
And you nailed it. Very impressive.
Thank you. So, allotriomorphic ferrite, is this like the evil twin of Widmanstedt and ferrite?
More like the lazy sibling. It's chemically the same stuff. It grows from the same parent structure. But we know for a fact that allotriomorphic ferrite grows by diffusion. It's the blob version.
And does the blob have the tilt?
Nope. No tilt. No shear, no military march. So Adeshi asks the obvious question. If both of these things are supposedly growing by diffusion, why does one look like a blob and the other look like a sheared plate?
That seems like a pretty damning logic trap.
It is. If the mechanism was the same, the result should be the same.
Okay, so we've got the glycyl interface. It can move. We've got the shape change. It looks like a march. But we have to talk about the steps.
Ah, yes. The stepped interface.
Because when they look at this thing under the super powerful microscopes, the boundary isn't a smooth line. It looks like a staircase.
Correct. It has terraces and risers.
And Rigsby, the opposition, saw these steps and said, aha, steps mean it's fitting together, like Lego blocks snapping into place. They thought the steps were just static, right? Just there to make the geometry work.
Exactly. They viewed them as geometric necessities. Just structural features to minimize energy, like to fit a square peg in a round hole, you need some gaps.
But Padeshia puts on his movement glasses again.
He does. He says, these aren't just steps. These are machines.
Machine.
He calls them transformation dislocations. He argues that the interface moves because the steps move.
Oh, wait, I'm trying to picture this.
Okay. Imagine an escalator.
Okay.
If you look at one step on an escalator, the metal tread is flat. It's horizontal and then it tips up or down.
Right.
So if you just stared at the metal tread, you might say, this step is flat. It's not moving up. But the escalator, the whole system, is carrying you to the second floor.
Oh, I like that. Yeah. So Rigsby is staring at the tread saying, this is flat. It's stuck. And Madeshia is saying, yes, but the step is sliding sideways. And that sliding is what builds the new structure.
That's it. Exactly. The step scans across the surface. And as it passes, it wipes the old structure away and replaces it with the new one. The motion of the steps is the transformation.
So the steps are the workers.
They are the engines of change.
And this leads to the point about curvature. I noticed the text mentioned the interfaces are often curved. Why is that a big deal?
It's a huge blow to the low energy argument.
Yeah.
The opposition claimed the interface was stuck at a specific angle because it was in a cusp, a low energy sweet spot.
Like a ball rolling into the bottom of a bowl.
Exactly. If a ball is at the bottom of a bowl, it stays there. It resists moving. If the interface was truly governed by this rigid energy cusp, it should be flat. It should be straight as an arrow.
But it's curved.
It's curved, which implies it's flexible. It's not locked into one rigid orientation. Padeshia argues this curvature proves the interface is glycyl. It's mobile, it can bend, it can adapt.
It really feels like every time the opposition says it's stuck, Padeshia points to a piece of data and says, look, it's moving.
That is the recurring theme.
Okay, so he's laid out this massive argument, but the document we have includes an addendum, and this was published months later.
Yes, received August 1983.
This feels like the part in the movie where the villain comes back for one last stare.
Or at least one last argument.
Yeah.
Rigsby and his team read Hadashia's paper, and they wrote a reply. They didn't just accept it, they pushed back.
And what did they say?
They doubled down. They argued that even if the whole interface looks tilted, the tiny facets, the treads of the staircase, mm-hmm. are sessile. So they claim the mechanism must be diffusion because those little steps are stuck.
And Fidacia's response in the addendum?
He basically says, read my paper again.
Yeah.
He reiterates the escalator point that you have to look at the interface as a whole system. But then he drops the hammer.
The annealing twin.
The annealing twin. This is the mic drop moment.
Explain this to me. What is an annealing twin? Is it another structure in steel?
Yes. It's a specific type of defect that happens when you heat treat certain metals. Now, here is the crucial fact. We know absolutely, 100%, without a doubt, that annealing twins form by diffusion.
Okay, so that's the control group. We know what diffusion looks like.
Exactly. We have a confirmed specimen of diffusion. Now, if you look at an annealing twin under a microscope, does it have the shape change? Does it have that tilted, sheared surface?
I'm guessing. No.
No, it is flat. The surface relief is totally different.
So Padeshia says, here is a diffusional thing, and it's flat. Here is Widmanstetten ferret, and it's tilted.
Precisely. He's saying, if your theory was right, that sessile steps create this shape, then annealing twins should have the shape too. They don't. Therefore, your theory is wrong.
That is pretty definitive.
It's a consistency check that the opposition just couldn't pass. You can't claim a mechanism causes effect X in one material, but not in another identical situation.
So after the paper, the addendum, the back and forth, who won?
Well, science is a slow process, but looking back from today, the Displacive Camp won.
The marchers were right.
The marchers were right. The consensus today is that Widmanstetten ferret forms via a displacive mechanism. The atoms move in a coordinated shear.
So here's my question. We've spent all this time talking about Adams marching versus scrambling. For the person listening who is maybe, you know, driving to work or folding laundry, why should they care?
That is the million-dollar question.
Does it matter if the Adams danced or walked as long as the bridge doesn't fall down?
It matters because we don't want the bridge to fall down.
Go on.
That basket weave shape of Widmansdettin ferret, that interlocking pattern of thin plates, that structure is incredibly good at stopping cracks.
It's a toughness thing.
Exactly. If a crack starts to run through the steel, it hits these plates and it gets diverted. It runs into a maze. That makes the steel tough.
Okay.
But to get that structure, you need to control how it grows. And if you understand that it grows by shear by a military march, you can predict exactly how fast it will grow at different temperatures. You can model the stress. You can engineer it perfectly.
And if you thought it was diffusion,
you'd use the wrong math. You'd predict the wrong growth rates. You might try to heat treat a giant steel beam and end up with a microstructure that is weaker than you thought.
So getting the theory right is actually a safety issue.
Absolutely. This isn't just academic bickering. This is the instruction manual for modern infrastructure.
You know, what sticks with me the most from this deep dive isn't just the physics. It's the nature of the argument itself.
How so?
I mean, think about it. Padeshia and Rigsby. Two brilliant groups of scientists. They are looking at the exact same electron microscope images.
Right.
They see the same black and white lines. They measure the same angles. They count the same steps. And yet, one sees a staircase that is locked in place, and the other sees an escalator that is moving.
It really is a powerful reminder of how science works. We tend to think of data as this cold, hard truth. But data is just ink on a page or pixels on a screen.
The truth is in the interpretation.
Exactly. You have to tell a story that fits the data. And in this case, the story of the military march just happened to fit the facts better than the story of the cocktail party.
It's a good reminder to question the story, even if you trust the data.
I always.
Well, I think I'm going to look at a steel bridge a little differently next time I drive over one. I'll be imagining all those little atoms holding hands and marching into place.
A disciplined little army keeping you safe.
I love it. Well, that's it for this deep dive into the atomic world of Widmansdettin ferret. Thanks for listening, and we'll catch you on the next one.